Welcome along again to the Last Word on Tennis podcast. This is the second in a kind of a range of three that we're going to produce here. We've talked about last week, we talked about people who are overappreciated maybe for what they've achieved in the world of tennis. This week we're going to talk about players that maybe don't get the appreciation that they deserve for what they've done in the game. So this is possibly a bit more of an upbeat and positive tennis podcast where we're going to hopefully maybe introduce some names to you that you may not have known from a different era, or maybe just remind you of how great some of these players were that don't get talked about so much these days. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what the guys have got to say. Again, I'm joined by Jack Rostermunley. Hi, Jack.
Hello, hello.
Joined by Ryan Schick.
Hey there, Andy.
We're also joined by Damian Cust again.
Hey there, everyone.
And then Amy Lundy is also with us again.
Hey, great to be back.
Absolutely. So let's get straight into it then. I can't because I've got the quiz. We've got another little quiz here. We're going to talk about a couple of people from this particular country in this to give a couple of teasers out as to who people might have chosen on the panel. What I want you guys to do at home is to think about all of the Swedish Grand Slam winners across men and women, not doubles, just singles. So can you name all of the Swedish Grand Slam winners going back through time? So that's the quiz question for this podcast. Also, like I say, gives a bit of a teaser as to who may have been chosen by our esteemed panel. Speaking of whom, we're going to start off this week with Jack Rostermunley, who's going to remind you of someone that you may not know that much about, Jack.
Absolutely. So on the underappreciated category, I can understand why this might seem like an odd choice, since she does have a court named after her and she does have a trophy named after her. But I picked Suzanne Lenglen, the French player who in her time was known in the press as the goddess. So like high profile. But as I was thinking about her, her achievements are so astounding. And there's the caveat that this was before tennis was as professionalized as it is now and all that kind of stuff. It's before the open era. But at the same time, what she did in her career is so unmatched by anything before or since that I am astounded that she doesn't have a higher profile now just within the sport of tennis as a legendary name that is constantly brought up. Because it wasn't just that she did these things on the court. She was like this mix of the elegance on court of Roger Federer. Off court, she gave quotes that were like Muhammad Ali. She drank in between sets like Ernest Hemingway. And she has a win percentage across her career that's even better than Nadal on clay. So like, she's got it all. A few numbers that kind of put her in context. Her career singles win percentage was almost 98%. She went 332-7. She ended her career on a 179 match win streak that ended because she stopped playing tennis. She had 83 singles titles, 74 doubles titles, and 93 mixed doubles titles. She won at Wimbledon and the French Open on more than one occasion. At the same slam, she won singles, doubles, and mixed doubles. She had 8 singles grand slams, 5 of which she won without losing a set. And from in her very best year of her career, which was 1923, she won 45 titles in that year alone. Her sort of greatest impending rival at the time, around when she gave up tennis, was Helen Wills, and the only match they played together was this massive media event. It was dubbed the match of the century. It was this rising talent, 20-year-old Wills and Suzanne Lenglen, who everyone knew at that point, who was 26, and she beat Wills 6-3, 8-6. Another element that goes into all of this greatness is that this was before there were deciding tie breaks. So she plays these absolutely astonishingly long sets at times in the course of her career. But as I said, beyond all this stuff that she was able to do on court, she was this huge personality off the court. She wore, what was for the time really risque clothing with like short sleeves, scandalizing people the world over, refused to come to the United States in the 1920s until she was given an exemption from prohibition so she could drink during her matches because she was so used to doing that. She was just like a huge character, a major media personality, and has absolutely everything. And I feel like if you look at the four Grand Slams, you've got Wimbledon, where there's no name on the center court because it's Wimbledon and tradition dictates that it's all special and grassy and whatever. But if you look at the Australian Open, you've got, you know, the main arena is Rod Laver Arena. If you go over to the US, it's the Billie Jean King Tennis Center and Arthur Ashe Stadium. And then you go over to the French Open and the main court is named after a French flying ace. And the slam is interchangeably given his name, Roland Garros. And I know that Suzanne Lenglen's name is on the number two court, but I do not understand why it is not the stadium court's name and why she isn't discussed all the time, because she is just a completely singular talent who only started playing tennis because she had like respiratory issues as a child. So like, what's that all about?
Thank you so much for that, Jack. You've educated me there as well. Obviously I've heard of Suzanne Lenglen and knew about her numbers, but can we just talk about the drinking for a second? Because that certainly piques my attention. What exactly was she down in? Was she on the, you know, on the wine? What was going on?
By all accounts, it was mostly brandy and cognac.
Oh, classy.
Depending on the match. Yeah.
And I can't help but feel like I have to be devil's advocate in these situations. And, you know, it was the very early on in the age of tennis, and what was, you talked about Helen Wills, a British tennis player, I believe. And what was the competition like? Was the competition that bad that she couldn't fail to win these titles?
The competition may not have been as strong as it would become, but at the same time, like if you're winning almost every match you ever play, you're clearly operating on a different level. It reminds me sort of the early years of chess. The American Paul Morphy, who taught himself how to play, at the age of like 15 or 16, he goes over to Europe and he beats everybody. And sure, the competition then wasn't as incredible as it would become. Chess theory hadn't advanced as far as it would eventually. But what Morphy did, his genius, is that he began to develop the rules upon which all the rest of chess became based, especially opening theory. And so what he had done is completely transcended beyond the era in which he was playing and started playing the game on a different level. And I feel like that's sort of what Lenglen was doing during this time. She took tennis to a whole new level that it had never been seen before. So the level of competition, however good or bad it was, it didn't match up to her.
Absolutely. And, you know, like I say, it doesn't matter the level of competition. If you're going out there and winning every week, then you are showing great mental strength to keep going and win all those titles, as well as, you know, obviously excellent skill on the court. And by all accounts, a fabulous person to go out on the lash with, which I can appreciate. Right. I don't know whether this person was particularly good to go out on the drink with, Damien, but you know, tell us all about who you've chosen as to be quite underappreciated in the world of tennis.
Yeah, I went slightly more modern. I chose Robin Söderling, who's just retired like 5 years ago, but hasn't played a professional match in 9 years. So most of you probably remember the guy. But when talking about underrated players, I feel like the common trope, let's say, is the careers that were cut short by injuries, illness. And one of these is definitely Robin Söderling. The funny thing about him is that he actually was a rather late bloomer. He reached his first Grand Slam fourth round at the age of 24. So that's what I think makes it an even sadder story, given that his arguable peak only lasted about two full seasons. Obviously, he had that incredible moment of announcing himself on the biggest stage ever, the 2009 French Open win over Nadal. That's still to this day one of only two losses for Nadal on the Parisian clay. Even more remarkably, it came in a great season for Nadal. So it wasn't like that other loss to Djokovic in 2015, probably Nadal's weakest season. Söderling lost to Nadal like 2 weeks earlier, winning just one game in Rome. And then completely turned it around two weeks later. So, and ever since that point, he was at the top of his abilities. He for the next two full seasons, he was definitely a force on clay. But not only, his game fit very well on faster surfaces too. He had very powerful ground strokes of both wings, and Clay just allowed him more time to get them, but he also had a very potent serve, so he was great on indoors. He won a Masters 1000 event in Paris in 2010, which obviously in this very competitive era of men's tennis is a rather rare feat when you look at different players. Also, his last season, 2011, was going very well. He was, as of July 6th, in the ATP race and won 4 of his 10 career titles that year. In 2010, he reached another Grand Slam final at Roland Garros, this time defeating Federer on the way. But, as I said about the illness, he was diagnosed with mononucleosis while he was actually sitting out from tennis with an injured wrist. And he tried to come back, but the recovery was very slow. It was a very severe case. And in 2015, in December, he announced his retirement after not having played a match for over 4 years. He later actually stated that he might return to tennis, but, you know, the clock is ticking. It's 2020. As of today, he's 35. But it's also, you know, rather probable that if it wasn't for the illness, we'd still be seeing him maybe in one of his last professional seasons. And that's clearly a very big talent, but we'll never really know how high the ceiling could have been.
Well, that's what I'm going to ask you now. So nicely led on. Without, you know, the obvious question is, you say he's underappreciated. Do you think we've been robbed of someone who would have competed, you know, alongside the big three, the big four? Or do you think it's someone who maybe would have been more of the Stan Wawrinka, who would have turned up at Grand Slams and won a couple? Or do you think this would have been someone who was right up there?
Yeah, something between them, probably. I mean, maybe he had a similar game plan to Stan, just a potent serve and two very big groundies. So I don't know. I mean, his best slam was the French Open, obviously, but he had his great results at Wimbledon, at US Open too. He never really had did anything at the Australian Open. But I think, you know, it would have been hard for him maybe to win a slam, because we know what it is at the French. You have to be very lucky not to get Nadal there. In the stretch from 2009-2011, he lost only to Federer and Nadal at the French, so I'm guessing he would definitely be something like Berdych, something like Tsonga for the next couple of years. But who knows? Maybe he would have, progressed even better. I mean, he had a great coach too. He worked with Magnus Norman, the same guy who later really did something amazing with Wawrinka, and who is often thought as the father of that success. So who knows, maybe if Söderling wasn't injured, wasn't ill, then maybe Norman would never have worked with Wawrinka, and maybe Söderling would be the Stan of today.
Yeah. And you think Söderling would have ended up more like Berdych or Tsonga, not like somebody like Del Potro?
Well, who's Berdych? I mean, how do we compare Berdych and Tsonga to Del Potro? I mean, Del Potro could probably be better than them, but he's also injured all the time, right? So I'm not sure.
True.
I'm not sure how to compare the three really here.
Well, I just mean in terms of like the ceiling that we know Del Potro can get to, I feel like is higher than even some of the best that you see from Tsonga and Berdych, just because there's still a mental edge that Del Po has over them.
Yeah, it depends how high you believe Del Potro's ceiling actually is. I've seen a great discussion about it on social media like 2 or 3 days ago, and I'm actually a believer in Del Potro. I think that he surely would have added to his slam tally if it wasn't for all the injuries. So maybe if Söderling was also injury-free, pain-free, not diagnosed with mononucleosis, I'd probably see him more as a Grand Slam potential guy than Tsonga, for example.
Yeah. I wonder whether, I mean, I'll ask this question to Amy. I wonder whether, Amy, the nationalities of people comes into underappreciate it. We know that, you know, the tennis world, or maybe even the tennis world in the media, is maybe dominated by a few countries. And if you come from maybe a less populous or less vocal country, do you think that sometimes feeds into players who are underappreciated?
No, I really don't. I mean, you might argue that if you come from the United States, you have all the media and all the resources, and some of the wealthier European countries. Whereas if you come from, you know, Bulgaria, where Dimitrov is from, you might not have access to the sponsorships that can put you out front and that kind of thing. But if you've got a winning way and that kind of personality and really the smarts to be able to hang, I think you'll emerge. It doesn't matter what country you're from.
Anybody got a different opinion on that?
I think there's sort of two sides to it. I think you either come from a country that has a large tennis infrastructure, or you can be sort of the sporting hero from your country. And that doesn't necessarily get you the global recognition. And obviously, you know, I think you're totally right. There's players like Dimitrov who are good looking, charismatic, like they're going to break through probably. But you look at somebody like Simona Halep, who even before she had a bigger international profile, she was a hero in Romania.
So, yeah, I just wonder how that lends into the overappreciated and underappreciated debate. We've got a few kind of nominations here from a few different people. We had Gavin from the LWOT staff who suggesting that the likes of Marat Safin, Evgeny Kafelnikov, Guillermo Vilas are underrated. We had a couple of people on Twitter as well, Rob Heath, who's been on a couple of podcasts recently, suggesting that Svetlana Kuznetsova doesn't get the credit that she deserves for her two Grand Slam titles. And also Phil Sigler suggesting that Petra Kvitova might be underrated. And then Sebastian Antonio has recently just got in touch and said that underrated is Justin Henin, who I know that one of our panelists was particularly close to choosing as their underrated players. Amy, maybe you just want to say a couple of words about Justin Henin before you mention your next person later on.
Yeah, she was the first one that came to mind, but then my one that I ended up choosing is so underrated that even I forgot that she's somebody that doesn't get near the acclaim. But Kvitova is an interesting one, whoever threw that in the mix. I remember Navratilova saying that Kvitova, and this is a direct quote from her, refuses to doll herself up because that's not Petra. And for that reason, doesn't get the sponsorships and the acclaim and all that. So that's interesting.
Ryan, you're going to take us back to mainly the 80s, I guess, with this person, although his career lasted into the 90s. And also this person maybe gives a further clue as to other answers for the quiz later on.
Yeah, so back to Sweden, just like Soderling. My person I'm going with is Mats Wilander. And not necessarily that he was, you know, equal to the other greats in his era, but I feel like he's underappreciated because he was a really great player, and you hardly ever hear him come up. I mean, he does have a broadcasting career, but you don't really hear about him much. When he was – I mean, if you look at his accomplishments, which I'm about to get into, in the grand scheme of tennis, he was really on borderline all-time great level. But I think part of it, just starting out, he's kind of overshadowed by – he fell on the – in kind of the in-between of the McEnroe-Connors era and then leading into the Lendl domination in the mid to late 80s, which is when Wilander peaked as well. And then into the early 90s, Sampras-Agassi era. And even in the late 80s and like 1990, 91, his countryman, Stefan Edberg, I guess won a little more and kind of got most of the highlights from that era. So he's kind of forgotten, but his accomplishments stack up to just about everyone in the history of tennis. So to kind of go through his career, he really became big in 1982 at the French Open. He was just 17 years old. He was unseeded, and he won the entire tournament as an unseeded player to become, at the time, the youngest ever Grand Slam champion, again at 17 years old. He went on to win 7 Grand Slams, which is 9th in the Open era, and as well as 3 Australian Open titles, which is the 4th most in the Open era. And he also reached three consecutive Australian Open finals, which has only been done also by Lendl and Novak Djokovic, which is a very great company in and of itself. He was also able to win 8 Grand Prix Series titles, which is back then was the now Masters 1000 kind of elevated status tournaments, and won 33 overall singles titles. In the prime of his career from 1983 to 1988, he reached 3 or more quote-unquote big finals of Slams or Masters or Grand Prix at the time, excuse me. He reached 3 or more finals of those events every single year from 83 to 88. And then I want to also focus on his peak season, which was 1988. He won 3 Grand Slam titles as well as 2 Grand Prix titles. And the only other people to win 3 Grand Slams in a year in the Open era are all 3 of the big 3, Jimmy Connors and Rod Laver. So it puts him in great company that his peak. And in 1988, Lendl was still playing. You had Edberg coming up. It may not have been the peak, you know, you didn't have McEnroe at his peak anymore, but it wasn't a poor era of tennis by any means. So the fact that Wielander was able to win those 3 tournaments is a very impressive feat, especially because he had won. So the one he didn't win was Wimbledon, but he had – this was, I believe, the second year the Australian Open had switched to hard court. So it was a new surface, new venue, and it was his first time playing the Australian Open since the switch, and he was able to win that tournament. Looking at him against his biggest rivals, he was 6-7 versus John McEnroe, 11-9 versus Edberg, and 7-5 versus Yannick Noah, who was another guy kind of in that second era he came up to. And so, you know, he wasn't dominating these guys by any means, but he really should be kind of looked at least a similar standing as those guys. Clay was his best service, but his worst surface was hardcore, which he still managed to have a 71.5 winning percentage on, and that alone would be the 24th best all-time match winning percentage, at least in the Open era, of anyone, which is, in my opinion, very respectable for his worst surface. And again, kind of piggybacking on that, I know Amy mentioned in the underappreciated podcast putting a premium on someone who can play on all 3 different surfaces. And so I kind of was looking at it the same way for Wielander. He's one of only 2 players in the Open era, along with Rafa Nadal, to win 2 or more slam titles on all 3 different surfaces, grass, hard, and clay. And if you're looking at it and you think that might kind of look funny because he never did win Wimbledon, he did win 2 Australian Opens back when it was held on grass. He won a hardcore Australian and a U.S., both on hard. And then he won 3 French Opens. So I think that's a very unique thing. And the fact that he and Nadal are the only 2 that have accomplished that, I think is very impressive and says a lot about having a true all-around game. So just to kind of wrap up my thoughts on Wielander is that, again, you know, I'm not saying he's at the Connors level or the Lendl level, but I think he should be brought up a lot of discussions on the great. You know, you have your 7-8 men who you think of as the great, but Wielander's right below them, and you don't really hear him come up, especially given someone who has 7 Grand Slam titles.
Yeah, you know what? That's a very good education again for me. I love this podcast. This one's really good. I think you've made a really good case for him there, Ryan, to be honest. So, I mean, it begs the question, why? Why is he not, you know, as fated, even as the likes of Lendl or, you know, Connors? Because those are, you know, relatively similar kind of level of achievements, I would say. And he's not as if he's short of personality either. You've seen him in broadcasting. He's got quite an effusive attitude to tennis. He clearly loves the game. So what is it about him, and why is he not more appreciated?
You know, that's something I'm looking at. I really couldn't find a great answer to. What we did talk about earlier with the countries and kind of the media, where if you're in the US or maybe the UK, you have a big big media presence, big following. And if like the Simona Halep example, where she's by far the biggest athlete from, in her case, Romania, and the whole country gets behind her, she's in that position where you had Borg before him and you also had Edberg, where he's from a fairly small country in Sweden, but also isn't the one guy, so he doesn't have kind of that to get behind him. But I think also is he was consistently very good, but he was always kind of the number two, whether it was he was behind Lendl or behind Edberg. And I guess in the looking long term, his seven grand slams came over several seasons, and he did have that dominant year in 88. But I think it's because there, when you think back of the late 80s, you're thinking of Lendl and Connors. You're thinking of, you know, 1990, 91, you're thinking of Edberg. And then anytime after that, you're thinking of Sampras. So he doesn't really come to mind when he was really right up there with those guys.
Yeah, just looking at the number of weeks at number one, maybe this gives us the overall answer we're looking for. Only 20 weeks at number one for Vilander, where Edberg was 72. Lendl 270, and obviously Jimmy Connors 268. So maybe that's the reason why he wasn't kind of number one for that long, and maybe he wasn't the man to be shot at for as long as the others. But thank you for that, Ryan. We'll move on to our final kind of underappreciated player here, and we're going to Amy here. So you hinted at her earlier. Who did you finally end up as your most underappreciated player?
It's Steffi Graf, and before you go, oh my gosh, what are you talking about? She's one of the greatest of all time. I got the idea when there was like a round table with Navratilova and Chris Everett, and they were naming off the all-time greats, and even Monica Seles was named, you know, Serena Williams, of course, Margaret Court. Steffi's name never came up. And I was sitting in front of the TV getting so annoyed. And I realized that these days when Steffi gets talked about, it's usually in the context of her husband, Agassi, who that annoys me because, you know, you could argue that she has a greater body of work over the course of her career. And then I did hear the comment the other day that, you know, somebody said, oh, what's Steffi up to? And the only, quote unquote, the only thing she's up to is that when she plays Agassi these days, when they play for fun, she regularly beats him. Apparently, he can't beat her anymore. So that just goes to tell you that she's a great player. 22 Grand Slams, and she did something that is just rare air. 1988, the Golden Slam. So she won all the Grand Slams and the Olympics. And it, again, as Ryan said, I place a premium on somebody who can win on all the different surfaces and not just win a great match or something here and there, but win an entire tournament on these diverse surfaces. Well, imagine doing that in 1 year. It's just an incredible accomplishment. So let's say that Serena gets her slam and she can put Margaret Court, you know, out of the conversation. Then I think there's going to be a real GOAT debate between Graf and Serena Williams. But I'm not sure it's going to shake out that way because Steffi's just more of a quiet person. And I just wanted to, I was just going through to prepare for this and looking at some of her records. You know, this is WTA rankings. Steffi Graf holds the record for weeks at number one. Steffi Graf holds the record for consecutive weeks at number one. Steffi Graf holds the record for year end number one and the record for WTA Player of the Year. And actually, consecutive weeks at number one, she's tied with Serena at 186. But she's at the top of all four of those lists. And you just don't hear that much about her.
I think you're absolutely spot on. So she won four Australian Opens. She won six French Opens. She won seven Wimbledons and five US Opens. Like, that's, you know, you talk about being able to play in different arenas on different surfaces. Like, that's insane. And even the ones that she didn't win, she bumped into a ridiculously good Monica Seles on a number of occasions, and she's made it to other finals where she might have lost to a young Martine Hingis or, you know, a few. So it's, even when she's not winning them, she's there or thereabouts. She never took a day off, did she, really?
Good quality competition. That's a great point.
She also had several strings of years where she barely lost matches. I mean,
yeah.
Just to bring in my own player for a second, it was Longlin-esque, the degree to which she just was destroying everybody she stepped on court against.
Yeah.
Six Grand Slam wins in a row from 95 to 96. She didn't play the Australian in either of those years, but every Grand Slam she played for 2 years, she won.
She just wasn't this big media personality, and there was a problem with her father and the taxes and stuff like that. So she had that stress chasing her. And of course, there was a Graf fan who stabbed Seles, so she had that around her. Mm-hmm. And I just think that she is completely underappreciated and not mentioned enough when we talk about the GOATs.
So Amy's obviously talking about that from her own perspective. And, you know, those of you that are listening from around the world, we've got obviously three people from the States here. We've got myself from the UK and Damien, who's from Poland. Damien, I want to kind of throw this over to you. I thought that Amy's, you know, hit the nail on the head here with Steffi Graf. But I wonder from your perspective, being from, you know, Central Europe, but obviously of the younger age as well, if you don't mind me saying so, how do you kind of personally look at Steffi Graf, and how do people that you know of who are also tennis fans from your kind of area look at Steffi Graf?
I think she's really much of a symbol. I actually wanted to say that maybe Martina Navratilova might suffer a different fate in the future, but maybe that's as you said, that's because of geography. But I feel like, you know, from the people I know, I think she's much less recognized right now than Steffi Graf. And she's, you know, her achievements obviously speak for themselves too. I mean, it's a fair point that maybe because we're the neighbors of Germany, that Steffi Graf is much better known here. And I think I don't really see that she, you know, that she isn't talked about to this day. I mean, I obviously, as Amy said, she has a quiet personality, so she doesn't show up in the media that often. Was the I don't know how to call it, the discussion you mentioned between Navratilova and Evert, or who was it?
It was, I seem to remember it was a round table discussion, and they were throwing out, you know, the greatest players.
Yeah, I think I've seen it, and you know, a point that came to my mind is maybe, you know, by talking about Steffi Graf, they would be kind of diminishing their achievements. I mean, Evert just well, barely, you know, their career is barely intercepted with Evert, but Navratilova a bit more. I don't know.
I think you make a great point about geography. We hear from Martina Navratilova all the time. She's on American television. She's highly politically active, so she's all over Twitter. I mean, I feel like she's, you know, she was on Dancing with the Stars. I feel like I hear from her almost every day, and I just never hear from Steffi, but maybe it is a geographical thing.
I mean, we never hear from Steffi either, I think, but no, we don't hear that much about Navratilova too. I mean, when it comes to Navratilova, it's obviously a highly controversial subject, but also her sexuality, the whole activism, that's definitely how she also stays in people's minds, right? That's, you know, stays active.
How old was she when she retired, Steffi Graf?
She died in,
I don't remember her being that old.
How old is she? Like 33 or what? I don't know.
I thought that she also retired. Maybe 30, but,
actually, 30 only, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was around about 30. But I suppose she saw, you know, a lot of people. You know, Serena was just about to come through. Venus was in there, and obviously Martina Hingis and Lindsay Davenport. So, you know, like you say, I think you made a very good point there early on, Amy, where you talked about the only time you ever kind of hear from her is when you talk about Andre Agassi as well. So, and, you know, as he had a great career as well, but like you say, her achievements, in my mind anyway, kind of outweigh his, and she shouldn't be hiding I don't think her light should be hidden away just because that she's with Andre. She was an enormous, massive player in her own right. And I remember growing up, she was always winning Wimbledon, right? So certainly in my mind.
I think you asked when she retired. She retired in 99. It looks like she retired at 30.
Yeah. So she could have gone on one more, you know, but she obviously had her reasons.
I recently reread Agassi's biography again, and I think it was stated there that she simply didn't have the motivation to compete again. She said that she was not having fun and accomplished all that she had to accomplish. I don't know.
Exactly. Right, well, underappreciated players then. You have a think at home of who you might have chosen for that. We had Suzanne Longlin, Robin Soderling, Mats Wilander and Steffi Graf nominated by our panel, and you heard a couple of other names in there as well from other contributors. And let's wrap this pod up then with the quiz. We've heard a lot of the names here, so what I'll do here is I'll go through each of our panelists in turn to name me a Swedish Grand Slam winner. We're going to go Damien first, if that's okay.
Stefan Edberg.
Stefan Edberg. Amy?
Borg.
Bjorn Borg. Ryan?
Wielander. I'll take the easy road.
Yeah. Jack? We've had all the easy ones, right?
All of the easy ones have been taken.
Yeah.
And now I'm stretching my brain. I know who won the Australian, right?
Yes. Mm.
Oh my god, I'm blanking on his name. Ah! I'm pretty sure I also got this guy wrong on a previous quiz.
Oh, I think you might have done, actually.
Yeah, because we did the one together about the last five Australian Open champions who were in B3, yeah?
Well, I'm glad I'm consistent.
Is anyone else?
Oh my god, save me, Damien, or anyone.
Thomas Johansson.
Oh my god, yes! I kept getting stuck on Burdick, and I couldn't...
Thomas Johansson, you need to remember that name.
I am never going to forget it now.
Well, we'll test you on that in the next pod. There is another one, though.
Oh.
If anyone knows it. It's from 1957.
Oh, come on.
Lord.
No way. Is it a man? Is it a man or a woman?
It's a man. There's been no female Swedish Grand Slam winners yet. Wait for Rebecca Peterson maybe to break that duck. His name is the most Swedish first name that you can probably think of. And then
Sven,
right? Yeah. And then the most British surname that I could think of probably
Smith?
Is Sven David.
Windsor?
Sven Davidson, 1957.
Never heard of him, sorry.
All right, Sven, coming in strong.
I can't see if I can find out which one he won. I haven't got the list in front of me. But yeah, 1957, Sven Davidson. If anyone at home got that one, write in. We'll give you a job on the spot, okay? So thank you, everybody, for contributing to that underappreciated list. Again, if you have any names that you want to throw out at home, please comment on wherever you see this on social media and also on the lastwordontennis.com website as well. Hopefully you'll join us again next week where we're going to be talking about what-if moments. So any moment that has happened in the history of tennis that if it had been slightly different, maybe we would have seen something amazing happen. So join us again for that one next week. Bye for now.
We'll ride off into the night. Air is clear, time is right. Feels so high coming down. Clouds are foaming all around. Take your time, fill it up. Drinking gin from a paper cup. We've got all of our lives to find out what we like. Running across oceans clean, telling stories where we've been, greatest tales ever told from the loved above.